Hi, my name is Alan Lindquist, and I work for the National Homeland Security Research Center in the Office of Research and Development of the Environmental Protection Agency. I'll be talking today about the properties and characteristics of pathogens on the next slide, slide 63. We have an overview of pathogens. First, what is a pathogen? Well, a pathogen is a disease-causing organism that can cause either illness or death. They may be also referred to as bioterrorism agents, replicating agents, select agents, pathogens, microorganisms, or microbes. These are all sort of synonyms. They share some characteristics. For example, large quantities of these may be grown up from small initial cultures, and they're unique in their ability to multiply in the body over time and to increase their effect. They may be referred to by their disease name or by their organism name. And some examples of this would be Salmonella typhi, which is an organism that causes the disease typhoid fever, Vibrio cholera, which is the organism that causes the disease cholera, and Yersinia pestis, which is the organism that causes the disease of plague. On slide 64, we see that there are several different types or classes of pathogens, and for convenience today, we'll be classifying them or discussing them in three general categories, the first being the bacteria, which includes the Rickettsia and Rickettsia-like organisms, the second is viruses, and the third being the protozoa. In the next slide, slide 65, the bacteria are, in fact, single-celled prokaryotic organisms that do not have nuclei. They're relatively easy to grow, many of them, and many do not require host cells for growth, and they often require simple media. This is excluding the Rickettsia and Rickettsia-like organisms now for the simple growth. But the Rickettsia may, in fact, require cells to grow in. They range in size from about one-tenth of a micron to 10 microns, and some of them are easily disinfected by chlorination. However, some of them can produce spores that are stable in environment for weeks or even months or perhaps even years. And may be quite resistant to things like chlorination as well as things like drying and pH and temperature. On the next slide, slide number 66, bacteria are susceptible to antibiotics, and many of them are susceptible to antibiotics. However, this is not universally true, and some of them actually carry genes that can cause them to be resistant to different antibiotics and can transmit these genes between different bacteria. Some examples of bacteria that are of concern for homeland security are Bacillus anthracis, which causes the disease anthrax, Burkholderia pseudomallei, which causes the disease melioidosis, Yersinia pestis, which causes plague, and Escherichia coli 015787, which causes hemorrhagic colitis and hemorrhagic uremic syndrome, or HUS. On the next slide, slide number 67, we discuss the viruses. Viruses are all obligate intracellular parasites that contain either DNA or RNA and a protein coat. Some of them also carry with them some enzymes, and they also may have a lipid envelope. They are unable to replicate or to metabolize unless they're inside of a host cell. So they're not really alive until they get into a host cell, where they commandeer the mechanisms of that cell to metabolize and to reproduce themselves. They're grown in cell cultures, or they can be grown in embryonated eggs, or in animals as well. They range in size. These are smaller than the bacteria, from about 0.01 microns to a tenth of a micron in size, from 1/100th to 1/10th of a micron. Stability for them can be a day or some weeks, and in some of them, the stability is in fact unknown. Antibiotics typically don't have an effect on these. However, there are some drugs that interfere with the enzymes that some viruses carry with them or are required in their growth. Examples of viruses that are of concern for homeland security include variola, which causes the disease smallpox, Khaleesi viruses, for example, Norwalk virus, which generally causes gastroenteritis or diarrhea, and the hepatitis viruses, for example, hepatitis A, which cause inflammation of the liver or hepatitis. In the next slide, slide number 68, we talk about the protozoa. Protozoa are single-celled eukaryotic organisms. The word eukaryotic means that they actually do have a nucleus. And they are they range from about 0.8 of a micron in size to 70 microns. So they're the same size as bacteria or quite a bit larger as well. Protozoa of concern are parasites. There are some other non-protozoan parasites that may be of concern as well, including some of the roundworms and other worms. Some of these protozoa produce cysts or oocysts that may be very stable and may be very stable in water. There are some specialized antibiotics that do work against some protozoan diseases, but in general, they're difficult diseases to treat. Examples of protozoa that cause diseases that are of interest would include Cryptosporidium parvum, which causes cryptosporidiosis, which is a gastroenteric disease, Toxoplasma gondii, which causes toxoplasmosis. Toxoplasmosis in pregnant women can cause abortion or birth defects of the child. It can also cause illness and death in immunocompromised individuals. And Entamoeba histolytica, which causes amoebic dysentery. On slide number 69, the next slide, we talk about the fate and transport of some of these. Now, pathogens, many pathogens are stable in water long enough to pose a threat to people. They may be stable for, again, as I said, a period of days or even weeks, months, or potentially years for some of these pathogens. They are in water in suspension rather than being in solution, which means that they can, in fact, settle out, and they do need to be distributed in water. This can cause their distribution in different parts of the distribution system to vary, and contamination can, for example, settle out in areas where there's still water. Exposure routes can include ingestion, inhalation, and or dermal contact. And as Stan State said earlier, one example of inhalational contact to pathogens would include the inhalation of Legionella pneumophila, which caused Legionnaire's disease. The health effects can be quite significant, arising from a very small volume of infectious material. A small volume of infectious material can affect a lot of people. They also may not cause immediate symptoms due to the incubation period in the host, and the symptoms can be vague and ambiguous. A lot of these diseases first are recognized as causing only flu-like symptoms, and that vague and ambiguous symptomology may cause a delay in the diagnosis and a delay in treatment and determining that, in fact, water was the cause of the disease. On slide 70, we see that we're beginning to define the property of infectivity. And what is infectivity? Well, it's a measure of the ability of a microorganism to establish itself in a host, in an individual of a host, and to begin to multiply. Now, frequently we express infectivity as infectious dose, and it's very common to see ID50 as a value that has been calculated for the infectious dose. The ID50 means the number of organisms that are needed to infect 50% of the exposed posts, hosts who are exposed in a given period of time. And how does this information help us to assess this threat? Well, if there's a pathogen with a low ID50 value, it may be a significant threat even when there are low concentrations of the organism present. However, introduction of a pathogen with a high ID50 value may in fact also have high impact, but it would require a greater concentration of the organisms to be present in order to have the same impact. On slide 71, we continue talking about infectivity. There are some limitations on the information of infectious dose. Some of these are our knowledge of the source of the estimate of the infectious dose is extremely crucial to the understanding of the significance of this number. ID50 values, for example, may be derived from a variety of different types of estimates. They may be estimates that are made at outbreaks, or they may be estimates from animal models, or in some rare cases, there may in fact be human dosing studies that have been done to estimate the infectious dose for 50% of the population. There is a variation in the reported and actual ID50s that actually are seen in an event. They arise from differences from strain to strain. They may arise in differences in the conditions which the organism was grown in, and there may be differences in host factors that cause the actual infectious dose in a given outbreak to be different from what was the reported infectious dose. So infectious dose values, when you're reading them, should include information about the route of infection, and in fact, infectious dose values for ingestion and inhalation may differ by several orders of magnitude. For one organism, for example, the infectious dose 50 value for ingestion is commonly reported as 10 to the 8th organisms, but for inhalation for that same organism, the ID50 value may be as low as 10 organisms. So these are very different numbers, and the route of infection becomes very important in determining the significance of a contamination. The doses that are lower than the ID50 may still cause illness, and in fact that relationship may not be linear. In fact, the dose that will cause illness in 1% of the population may be quite a bit lower than what you would predict simply by calculating the proportion of the population of the ID50 and calculating the dose by that number. There are some studies that report what is called a minimum infectious dose, or sometimes simply report what is called the infectious dose, and those studies can be quite a bit different from the ID50 number that's reported. Many pathogen detection methods also don't provide information on infectivity. So this is important in that a pathogen may be detected, but it may not be in a form that is capable of causing an infection, and therefore the relationship of the number of pathogens that were detected may not give an indication as to what the actual infectious potential of that sample is. On the next slide, slide number 72, we talk about incubation period. And the incubation period is the time between the exposure, which would be the time that the person either consumed or inhaled or was normally exposed to the organism, and the appearance of symptoms. And how does this information help us when we're assessing threats? Well, pathogens with longer exposure times may no longer be viable, or they may have been flushed out of, they may not be present in the water system after the beginning of the onset of symptoms. And if there's a continuous source of a pathogen, then the pathogen with a longer incubation period may in fact allow more people to be exposed. And we can imagine that if the water is continuously exposed, a pathogen with a two-day incubation period, a certain number of people will be exposed over the course of those 2 days. Whereas if the incubation period were a week or longer, a much larger number of people would be exposed in those additional days in which they're exposed to water. What are limitations of this information that you need to be aware of? Well, the actual incubation period is going to be dependent on a number of things, one of which is the initial dose. Typically, if the dose is low, the incubation period is longer. If the dose is higher, the incubation period is shorter. Also, the virulence of the organism and the severity of the disease produced will have an impact on the incubation period. Typically, the more virulent the organism, even within a species, the more virulent strains may in fact have shorter incubation periods than less virulent strains. Also, the inherent rate of replication of an organism may depend on the state in which it was being cultured or the state in which it was put into the water or the life cycle state of the organism as well. And then finally, the health of the host, whether or not a person is immunocompromised, may have some impact on the incubation period as well. On the next slide, we talk about virulence factors, another property called virulence. And what is virulence? Well, virulence is a measure of the ability of an organism to cause severe disease or death. One measure of the virulence that's frequently used is the case fatality rate, or CFR. This is also known as the mortality rate. And generally, the case fatality rates are calculated as the number of deaths per 1,000 or per 100 individuals who have clinical illness. Another measure of virulence that you might hear is called morbidity, which is a more difficult number sometimes to get information about, and it's the number of people who have disease of a certain severity. The endpoint for morbidity may be hospital admission, may be the requirement for certain types of medication or certain types of medical information to stay alive. Medical assistance to stay alive. How does the information about virulence help us assess the threat? Well, diseases with higher mortality rates may in fact be of greater consequence to homeland security, but there are some limitations that you should be aware of when you're looking at mortality rate in particular, but also other information concerning virulence, and that is that treatment may in fact affect the mortality rate. So that frequently mortality rates will be based on the fact that there'll be untreated and treated individuals. In treated individuals, typically mortality rate is quite a bit lower than those individuals who have not received treatment. Mortality rates are also very dependent on correctly identifying the underlying cases, so that the case definition that's used in generating the mortality rate will be very significant. For example, there may be 100 individuals who are exposed to and develop some clinical symptoms of a disease, of whom one dies, giving you a mortality rate of 1%. However, if you set a different clinical definition of those individuals who reported to the hospital, perhaps only 2 individuals of those 100 who had the clinical symptoms of disease reported to the hospital, of them, one died. So now we have a mortality rate of 50%. So you see the simply the definition of what is a case and who was sick can greatly change the understanding of mortality rate in any given disease. On slide number 74, there's another property that's very significant to public health, and that's communicability. And communicability is the ability to transmit disease from person to person, or the property of being contagious. And how does this help us assess information? Well, even though you have stopped the use or stopped the exposure to contaminated water, for example, this may not, in fact, stop new infections from occurring from communicable pathogens via the secondary transmission or person-to-person transmission routes. The degree of communicability may depend upon the strain of the organism related that was released, or it may also depend on the sanitary habits of individuals. And in fact, stopping use of water can change the sanitary habits of individuals as well, and may in fact enhance person-to-person spread or communicable spread of a disease. On slide number 75, we look at stability as another property of organisms. And the stability, by that we mean the capability of surviving in a variety of different environmental factors that would be present in a water distribution system. These would include temperature, pH, osmotic pressure, different chemical concentrations within and outside the pathogen, and the residual chlorine. How does this information help us assess the threat? Well, stable organisms within the environment, or organisms that have environmentally resistant life cycle stages, for example, spores of anthrax or Cryptosporidium oocysts, may survive longer in the distribution system, and some of these, in fact, may be more or less susceptible to residual chlorine, either increasing or decreasing their relative possibility of transmission and their relative goodness of use as a intentional contaminant. On slide number 76, some of the limitations that you should be aware of when assessing information about stability is that the data on organism stability may come from a variety of different types of studies. They may be using different types of organisms or different organism strains, different system conditions, and those system conditions may not be in effect in the particular distribution system that the contamination is occurring. On slide number 77, treatability is yet another property to be considered. Treatability is the capability to remove or inactivate organisms by various water treatment processes. And this helps us assess the threat by helping to determine the effectiveness of treatment at a water treatment plant, if, for example, an organism might be added to source water, and then also to look at the effect that chlorine residual might have on a particular contaminant if it were present in the distribution system. It also allows the evaluation of effectiveness of different options to decontaminate the water distribution system or a contaminated water system. There are, however, still some limitations that you should be aware of, and these are very similar to the ones in the previous slide, that different organisms may have been used in developing treatability data, and also the conditions under which the treatability data were developed may vary greatly from the actual conditions present in the field. And on the next slide, we look at challenges for detection of the different of these different organisms. Most pathogens of concern are not going to be detected during the routine monitoring for contaminants or for indicators of water quality, for example, coliform testing. And the analytical results, even if they are done to detect pathogens, may not be indicative of either virulence or of infectivity. So an analytical result telling you that you have in fact detected a pathogen that is a pathogen of concern will not necessarily tell you that that pathogen is virulent or infective. Also, water concentration techniques can be used prior to the analysis. However, even given the water concentration technique, the overall sensitivity may in fact be below the concentration of concern for some of these pathogens, which, as we said, are quite virulent and likely to cause disease at very low concentrations. And many on-site drinking water quality, drinking water utility laboratories are currently capable of monitoring for indicator organisms. Some of the laboratories can, in fact, conduct assays for some of the common waterborne pathogens. However, the capability and capacity for many of the specific pathogens must be expanded. In slide number 79, there are some additional challenges for detection. One is the Select Agent Program. This is a program that regards the control control and possession and transportation of the select agent pathogens, for example, Bacillus anthracis. And those control, possession, and transportation of these pathogens has to be done by approved laboratories. Failure to comply with the select agent program can result in jail terms and heavy fines for laboratories that do not comply. So, for example, a laboratory that found that it may in fact have a contamination problem, if it was confirmed, would have to follow very, very strictly the letter of the law for that particular pathogen. Many of the select agent laboratory approved laboratories that are conducting analyses are a member of what is called the Laboratory Response Network, which is a network of laboratories operated in conjunction with the APHL and the Centers for Disease Control that specifically deal with these laboratories. The next section on slide number 80 is the properties and characteristics of radiochemical agents, and that will be presented to you by Neil Nelson.